Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Joshua Weinberg, the new president of the Association of Reform Zionists of America. We'll also have a visit from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Last week, the former Prime Minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon, died after existing in a coma since a massive stroke suffered in office almost exactly 8 years ago, back in January of 2006. Zichrono Livracha, may his complicated memory be a blessing, and may he rest in peace. Alav HaShalom. Ariel Sharon just could be the single most controversial figure in the entire 65 years of Israeli history so far. He played a central part in Israel's story, from the War of Independence in 1948 all the way through the withdrawal from Gaza in 2005, and he was integral to some of the most dramatic events in Jewish history. Just what you thought of Sharon might well depend on your political viewpoint, but it might also depend on which period of Sharon's life and actions you were looking at. He was a military hero of three wars, a wildly successful commander who might have saved Israel during the Yom Kippur War, and a very powerful prime minister who changed the whole direction of both Israeli politics and its relationship to occupation. He was also a remarkably insubordinate military officer, a general accused of war crimes at Sabra and Shatila, and a turbulent and spectacularly manipulative political operator. To many, the man who disastrously provoked the Second Intifada, and a continuing lightning rod for controversy. In all of Israeli history, only Ariel Sharon could be both the godfather of the settlements in the occupied territories and the author of the plan to withdraw from many of them. To illustrate this, one of the largest, best established, and most challenging of the settlements in the territories is in the West Bank, called Ariel, a city of 20,000 deep in the West Bank. And it's named after Ariel Sharon. But famously, he was also the man who looked at the challenge of continuing to occupy a deeply hostile population in Gaza, noted the demographic potential catastrophe for the Jewish state, and turned a complete about-face and withdrew from the troubled territory. Raised as a dyed-in-the-wool believer in Zev Jabotinsky's revisionist Zionist philosophy, and the prince and then the king of the Likud party, when he decided that it was time to pull out of Gaza, he knew that the Likudniks who had serenaded him with Arik Melech Yisrael, Ariel, King of Israel, would not stand for it. So he simply built a brand new centrist party around himself and made it the majority party and went ahead, all in record time, as only Sharon could. There were many ironies to Sharon's life, particularly in his stroke and disabling coma, just when he was changing from a life of warfare and political infighting to becoming a dramatic peacemaker. How could the same man who was an aggressive builder of settlements, who went up on the Temple Mount and provoked Palestinian terrorism, suddenly withdraw from Gaza and embrace a final settlement approach? Only Sharon could contain within himself such apparent contradictions. You know, when Ariel Sharon died this last week, it seemed anticlimactic since he has been in a coma for so long, 8 years. But in many ways, his legacy, for good and not so good, remains a huge part of Israel today. In both his policies and his actions, he was sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always very, very influential. Ariel Sharon was a hero of the failed Battle of Latrun during the 1948 War of Independence, a rising star in the Israeli military thereafter, the tank commander who led the lightning strike across Sinai that captured the territory for Israel in the Six-Day War. He was widely credited with turning the tide of the Yom Kippur War against Egypt with his tank crossing of the Suez Canal and his bold encirclement of the Egyptian army. By all accounts, he was one of the most effective officers in the extraordinary history of the Israeli army. But Ariel Sharon was also a constant thorn in every superior's side, overriding orders and such. He was considered the single most arrogant and insubordinate officer in the often arrogant and disobedient IDF officer corps, as well as one of the most devious and attention-seeking. It was Sharon's insubordinate quality that prevented him from achieving his great goal of becoming the chief of staff of the IDF. He did return to command, however, as defense minister under Menachem Begin, and during the Lebanon War of the early 80s, he again led a strikingly effective Israeli military all the way up to Beirut, apparently without his superior's approval or even full knowledge. In the complex morass of that country's military and religious entanglements in Lebanon, Arik Sharon met what looked like his political end. In the wake of the assassination of their popular hero by Palestinian Muslim terrorists, Christian Lebanese phalangist allies of Israel slaughtered Palestinians in the refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila. The IDF failed to intervene, perhaps at Sharon's instructions, and Ariel Sharon became a political pariah, both in Israel and internationally. He was forced into a military and political exile of sorts, still in the Israeli cabinet, but no longer a key player. On his ranch in the Negev, he continued to be a successful agricultural entrepreneur and plan his return. Sharon's ambition did not disappear, it never disappeared, and he remained in power on the Israeli right, a leading figure for Likud. As Likud finally moved into government, he became an important minister, serving as the head of the department that built so many settlements in the territories. He was seen as their father figure. In typical Ariel Sharon way, when he saw an opportunity, he did not miss it, regardless of the consequences for others. After the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, his longtime colleague in the IDF and a fellow officer of great reputation who became the peacemaker of Oslo, Bibi Netanyahu rose to become prime minister for the first time. Sharon was eventually his foreign minister. After Netanyahu's thorough electoral defeat, Sharon became the de facto head of Likud. When Sharon chose to go up on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, helping to trigger the homicide-suicide bombing attacks that brought down Shimon Peres's last government, he presented himself as a strong leader who could end that second Arab Intifada. Elected Prime Minister of Israel, he did just that, stomping, the Palestinian terror attacks that had so damaged Israel, building the wall. And then he reinvented himself again when he realized that the demographic threat to Israel posed by the increase in Palestinian population in Gaza needed to be addressed. Having fathered so many settlements, he now chose to leave those in Gaza and withdraw from that troubled territory. It was a stunning turnabout for a man of power and war. Having crushed a Palestinian uprising, he now voluntarily handed over territory to them. In order to facilitate the policy changes Sharon thought essential for Israel, he left his longtime political home, Likud, forming a new centrist party, Kadima, which was poised to make further territorial concessions to the Palestinians to get a final peace settlement. Whether it would all have worked or not is unknown and unknowable, but Ariel Sharon was not a man to be underestimated. Shortly after withdrawing voluntarily and unilaterally from Gaza, and before he could work out West Bank arrangements, Sharon was felled by a massive stroke, almost exactly 8 years before his ultimate death. Like the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin in 1995, the loss of its leader at a critical moment proved to be the undoing of Israel's peace efforts. Shortly after Rabin died, the Oslo process unraveled completely. Shortly after Sharon's stroke, the Islamic fundamentalist terrorists in Gaza, Hamas, overthrew Fatah and made any peace deal with the Palestinians impossible. Ariel Sharon's legacy is complicated, but his role in shaping today's Israeli reality is evident. Perhaps the most important lesson we can learn from Sharon is that even this hard-boiled, right-wing, ultra-pragmatic general came to believe that peace had to be achieved with the Palestinians, and that to do so, Israel would need to give up territory and do so on its own terms. Sadly, only Sharon, reviled for 2 decades for his role in Sabra and Shatila, could have managed such a delicate transition and somehow made it work. We will not see another Ariel Sharon in Israel, just as we will not see another Yitzhak Rabin or Shimon Peres, for that matter. This pivotal, powerful, accomplished generation is going or gone. But this lesson of Sharon's life is still central for Israel in determining the direction it must go in the future. To play us in this morning, here's a classic song of the Yom Kippur War in which Ariel Sharon more or less saved his country. It's called HaMilchama HaAchrona, The Last War. Ani Mavtiach Lach, I promise you, my little girl, that this will be the final war.
Ani matiach lach yalda sheli ktana shezot tihye hamilchama ha'achrona ani matiach lach yalda שזאת תהיה המלחמה האחרונה בשם כל הטנקיסטים ופניהם המאובקות אשר עברו את כל האש והשחיקות בשם הימאים אשר פשטו על הנמלים ועיניהם כבדות ממלח וגלים אני מרתיח לך ילדה שלי קטנה הטייסים אשר פרצו אל קרב זועם ונצרפו באש טילים ואש נונמם בשם הצנחנים שבין עופרת ואשל ראו אותך כמו מלאך מעל ראשם אני מרתיח לך ילדה שלי קטנה שזאת תהיה המלחמה האחרונה אני מבטיח לך ילדה שלי קטנה
That was המלחמה האחרונה sung by Yehoram Gaon, a song of the Yom Kippur War in memory of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Our guest this morning is the new head of an important but poorly understood organization that advocates for Israel today. It is ARTSA, the Association of Reformed Zionists of America, making a big comeback. And Rabbi Josh Weinberg will explain why it exists and just what it seeks to accomplish nowadays when we return here on Too Jewish.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Josh Weinberg is the head of ARTSA. Josh, it's a great organization, but a lot of people don't know what it is in our listening audience. Can you explain what ARTSA is?
100%. Thanks for having me.
Delighted to have you.
I just relocated to New York after living 10 years in Israel, and I was just ordained by the Hebrew Union College's Jewish Institute of Religion's Israeli Rabbinic Program.
Right.
And it's really an opportune time for me to work towards connecting the liberal movement in America with the liberal Jewish movement in Israel. I realize that Israel desperately needs liberal Judaism, and liberal Judaism desperately needs Israel. So Artsa is the organization, we're the affiliate of the Reform Movement, and we're the Zionist wing of the movement. That means that we, essentially, we are created to represent the North American Reform Movement, now called the URJ, at the World Zionist Congress. You have to have a Zionist organization to do that, and that Congress meets every 5 years. We're just gearing up for the next campaign for the elections for the World Zionist Congress, and we're there to help represent the Reform Movement, our values, our perspective, and what we think Israel should look like. When we do well at the World Zionist Congress, it means a few things. It means that there's considerable funding that goes to our movement in Israel. In addition, we put people in key positions within some of the organizations in Israel, like the World Zionist Organization, like the Jewish Agency, like the Jewish National Fund, the JNF. And they're in the position to make key decisions that are aligned with our values. And the third thing is that we have a relationship with political parties in Israel. Right now, we're in a faction with Labor and Meretz. And we work together with them to see where we overlap and to see where we want to work together on certain issues and certain values and to help improve Israeli society.
So, as an American Jew, someone living in America, or even as a non-Jew who happens to have the good taste to listen to Too Jewish, what does Artsa do for people here? How does that connect them to Israel?
Mm-hmm. So our big thing is that we run our election campaign where we say, here's a direct way to influence what happens in Israel and Israeli society. Now, how many Jews in America were ever asked to vote on anything that really mattered? Maybe your synagogue elections or maybe your organizations, but something on a national scene where we can say, and by the way, Israelis vote too for the World Zionist Congress. They just do it through their Knesset vote.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Ah.
So when I, as an Israeli, voted for the political party that I voted for, they were represented twice in the Knesset and the World Zionist Organization. So now, how do you, as an American Jew, voice your opinion on what should happen with the world's money, right? With all the money that we donate and collect to the entire diaspora? Well, we have to vote. Right? It has to be democratic. So you vote for your slate. My hope is that you'll vote for Artsa, because we represent the largest Zionist organization in the United States, and that's through the Reform Movement, and we're able to voice our opinion that way. Now, what else we do is that we help support the Reform Movement through funding and through fundraising. In Israel, that's whether it's building buildings for communities or helping them build the movement there, and we also help bring Israel to the American public. Right. The American Jewish public.
We will explore those questions and much more with Josh Weinberg of Artsa when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome Pam and David of Freedom Smoke. So your product, a smokeless way to get off of tobacco, people don't really understand exactly what's wrong with cigarettes, or they think it's the same thing that's wrong with your product. Can you explain the difference?
That's true, Rabbi Kohan. Part of it is cigarettes themselves, the FDA made them release the ingredients. There's over 3,000 ingredients in cigarettes. There's four ingredients in electronic cigarettes. Propylene glycol, vegetable glycerine, flavorings from Flavor Art in Italy, who is who we use, and nicotine itself. Our nicotine is USP hospital grade. It's the finest that you can purchase. Nicotine in and of itself is not harmful to the human body. That's why we have so many doctors referring patients that they just cannot get to quit smoking cigarettes. They send them to us for a much healthier alternative.
And where do people go and how do they find your stuff?
They can go to one of our three stores here in Tucson. We've got one at Orange Grove and River, one at Broadway and Swan, and one at 12th and Valencia. Or they can go online to freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thanks very much, and we'll talk next week.
Always a pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there. The Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcasts. And now we welcome a favorite, mystically recurring feature, our Zen Judaism moment, the 2Jewish Haikus for Jews. Beyond Valium, peace is knowing one's child is an internist. And is one Nobel Prize so much to ask from a child after all I've done? That was our Zen Judaism segment, two classic haikus for Jews, koans of Zen Judaism. The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is set June 11th to June 23rd, 2014. If you're interested in going with me on this fantastic journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to Jerusalem to Masada, please email 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and itinerary.
We welcome our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, the head of the Weintraub Israel Center here in Tucson. Boker Tov. Good morning, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Oshrat, when I was in Israel a long time ago, I had the privilege of working with the Ethiopian Klita, the absorption of Ethiopian immigrants at a very basic level. It's now 23 years since many of the Ethiopians came in the last great wave of Ethiopian immigration. Some more have come since, but that's the majority. How are they assimilating into Israeli society? Give us a little bit of an overview and then maybe some specifics.
Okay, this is a very big question. Actually, 2 years ago, it was a year of, we indicated 30 years of absorption from Ethiopia, and a lot of discussion were around this topic. Did the Israel government and also the people did a good job, great job of absorbing the new immigrants from Ethiopia? And I can give you at least two answers: yes and no. On one level, we did our best because we need to consider the starting point, like the cultural differences were huge, but it's very make me happy and proud to see many Ethiopians right now in a very high a very high position in the government and other, but still, there is a lot room of improvement, for improvement. Yeah.
A lot of room for improvement. So,
yeah, thank you.
I know that the Gulf initially was tremendous. There were Ethiopian Jews who had never seen a doorknob. There were Ethiopian Jews who didn't know what a light switch was. The people from Addis, not so much, but the people from Gondar, really, Stone Age, didn't have metal in many cases. So obviously, moving into a modern society changes things dramatically. Now it's been a long time, and it always seems to me that the military is the sort of universal socializing institution in Israeli
melting
society.
Pot.
Yeah, the melting pot.
Yeah.
Some Ethiopians have risen. There are also, we hear claims of discrimination. What do you think about the overall status?
I think that what you just mentioned is right, but it's not just that to get used to the day-to-day life. It's something more mentally, like in Ethiopia, most of them came from Gondar, not from Addis.
Right.
So, and most of them get to, to the same style of life. There was not a huge gap between people. So they felt like the other. And only when they came to Israel, they felt like the huge difference since first from what they expected Jerusalem to be, you know, right. Jerusalem of God, right. And from, you know, the hierarchy in a family and lots of other issues that really affect on their klita.
The whole absorption and their yeah. whole social structure was changed yeah. dramatically. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can explore some of those issues next week and continue on this topic.
Yeah, yeah, I would like to.
We'll see you next week.
Yeah.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, J-E-T-C-O, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. The state of Arizona allows its taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations, who then provide scholarships for kids from kindergarten through 12th grade to attend qualified private schools. JETCO helps provide a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get a 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Tax credit's not a deduction. Your taxes are reduced by the amount you give. Join over 750 supporters last year who donated money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. There's an additional tax credit now, the switcher credit, which increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,031 for single filers, $2,062 for married couples filing jointly. When we are fighting every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, we should all take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to help foster a Jewish identity for our community's children. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive the financial aid they need to receive a good Jewish education. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, call 520-647-8442, again 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of education.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, there have been a number of stories about, so long after the Holocaust, about recovered art masterpieces that were hoarded, in one case, by a collector who sold art for the Nazis so they could put money away in Swiss bank accounts. There have been several other treasure troves like this that had belonged to Jews, been confiscated or forced sales at very low prices right before the Holocaust. They're in museums all over the world, too. This is an interesting and weird story that not only doesn't go away, it seems to get bigger even now. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting field because I think in general, high-end art sales are secretive, often mysterious, often tinged with elements of danger or criminality. And I know actually one very bright young woman who works as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal in Berlin, and her beat is the international art market and particularly forgeries, because one of the things that makes this all so difficult is how many copies of a certain painting actually exist. And it's a really good forgery just as valuable as the real thing? Well, obviously not. But I mean, what you're talking about, I think, is really multiple stories of art which was either confiscated or looted or stolen or bought at bargain basement prices from Jews who had to flee Germany and elsewhere, and then ended up in somebody's hands, either a private collector or a German government official or an official of one of the governments which cooperated with Germany, or in some cases in public, on public display, as you say, in museums or whatever, but the provenance of that art is Jewish private collectors and owners. And I mean, one of the dicey things about this is often the heirs of that Jewish owner or collector might be living in poverty somewhere in Israel or Russia or even Germany itself.
Or New York, you know, America, it could be anywhere.
And might really need the money. On the other hand, the huge, almost unimaginable quantity of priceless art that was stolen from Jewish private collections throughout Europe, I mean, France, Germany, wherever.
Hungary.
Austria, whatever. Also could tend to help us understand one of the sources of anti-Jewish sentiment in Europe in the 20s and 30s, which was that Jews were so wealthy that they could afford these impressive collections of stuff that many less fortunate people felt should be part of the public good, should be in museums or in universities or whatever. So the simple quantity of incredibly famous, valuable art that was in Jewish private hands was probably one of many factors that fueled the fires of anti-Semitism throughout Europe in the 20s and 30s, throughout the global depression and all that.
It's an interesting question. Maybe we'll explore it a little bit more next week. Thanks very much, Tom. We'll talk then.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. As soon as Shabbat services end, little Benji walks up to Rabbi Bloom and says, "When I grow up, Rabbi, I'm going to give you lots of money." Rabbi Bloom laughs and replies, "That's very good to know, Benji, but why would you do that?" And Benji replies, "Because my dad says you're the poorest rabbi we have ever had." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Mishpatim includes as many laws as nearly any other part of the whole Torah. After the last few weeks of spectacularly dramatic Torah portions featuring some of the highlights in the entirety of Jewish tradition, indeed of all religious history, Mishpatim comes as a major letdown. Last week, amid the smoke and thunder of Mount Sinai, we received the Ten Commandments. The week before, God parted the sea for us, and we miraculously crossed on dry land. And the weeks before that, 10 plagues struck the Egyptians, and Pharaoh and Moses had their duel of wills in the desert. But Mishpatim is nothing more than a collection of laws about how to interact with other human beings. Civil legislation. How exciting. How to handle somebody else's property fairly. How to assess punitive damages for a man who injures another person or destroys someone else's property. How to act when someone puts his or her property in trust with you. The laws of manslaughter, theft, damages. If the Torah is truly our fundamental moral text, this is an array of detailed legislation about human interaction that seems so trivial as not to belong in the Torah at all. So why is Mishpatim here? In truth, we human beings have no love of law or of lawyers. But without laws and without enforcement of them, we wouldn't function well at all. In fact, the Mishnah tells us we would tear each other apart. And where anarchy reigns, justice simply doesn't. And that's where Mishpatim comes in. For we need law, and we need limits, although we might not like either one very much. Judaism understands that if we are to be truly good or truly free, then we must observe the laws and rules of human decency, embodied in the code of legislation that makes up Mishpatim. Before we can love another human being as we love ourselves, we must respect that human being's property and person. Interestingly, at the end of this week's Parsha, after all the rules and laws, these torts and talionises, God reveals a glimpse of the divine essence to Moses, a personal revelation. It's a change of pace for such a legally focused text, but there is a great lesson here. In this way, Mishpatim teaches us that we can only experience real holiness when we begin by respecting our fellow men and women. When we come to understand that we are all in this together, that the way to God is actually through the ways we learn to work together and to trust one another. And we must do this in simple, practical, daily ways by following decent rules for human interaction. Poet Adrian Rich put it well, "These atoms filmed by ordinary dust, that common life. freedom. It isn't once to walk out under the Milky Way, feeling the rivers of light, the fields of dark. Freedom is daily, prose-bound, routine remembering, putting together, inch by inch, the starry worlds. Freedom and holiness are dependent on the little laws established in Mishpatim, and we can achieve both when we learn and follow the best of them. When we come back here on Too Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Josh Weinberg, will explain what it means today to be a Reform Jewish Zionist and how what we do deeply impacts Jewish life in Israel. Find out when we return on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The American Jewish community was outraged over news that 2 weeks ago Israel's Rabbanut, the chief rabbinate, rejected Rabbi Avi Weiss, a leading modern Orthodox rabbi, from testifying to the validity of a conversion or a marriage, as we reported on Too Jewish. Abe Foxman of the ADL, a former guest of Too Jewish, found it disturbing, decried it as a witch hunt. Other notable figures in the Jewish world were equally dismayed, and rightly so. Rabbi Weiss has demonstrated a love of Israel and a deep commitment to Judaism for many years, and is an influential and important American Orthodox rabbi. There should be no doubt as to the status of his converts or those he marries. Well, this past week, the chief rabbinate reversed course, decided to recognize Rabbi Weiss yet again. It seems clear that this was a response to widespread outrage among important Jewish organizations in the diaspora and in Israel. Israeli Diaspora Affairs Cabinet Minister Naftali Bennett cited concerns for Israel-diaspora relations in his efforts to resolve the Weiss case. It's notable that this seems to be the first time the Rabbanut has ever reversed its removal of a rabbi from its approved list, and that it happened in response to negative reactions in America. Perhaps we can hope that continued pressure from more sane influences in the Jewish world will bring about a reform of the rather terrible institution of the chief rabbinate for the good of Klal Yisrael, the unity of the Jewish people. In other news, dozens of Israelis released giant helium balloons last week to protest settler attacks against Palestinians, the annual rate of which has almost quadrupled in the last 8 years. The balloons were released by Jewish and Arab protesters at several sites simultaneously in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and in between, Dormition Abbey on Jerusalem's Mount Zion, Latrun, Route 1 near Abu Ghosh, and Tel Aviv's HaShalom Bridge and Central Bus Station. They also released balloons in the northern Israeli Arab town of Baka al-Gharbiya. There have been 2,100 so-called price tag attacks on Palestinians since 2006, the year they started counting. The annual totals are up from 115 in 2006 to 399 in 2013. The rate of these attacks has apparently risen since the current round of peace talks began. Israeli leaders repeatedly have denounced such attacks. Defense Minister Moshe Ya'alon last week branded them outright terrorism. And the Israeli military says soldiers are under strict orders to stop them. Police spokesman Mickey Rosenfeld said police have formed special units to deal with the price tag attacks. A West Bank unit with 30 officers started working a year ago, focusing on these price tag attacks. The army said Palestinian complaints about settler attacks during the annual olive harvest dropped
dropped by half to 20 from 2012 to 2013. Still, critics say Israeli governments have been reluctant to confront settlers, even those seen as a hardline fringe. There's not enough pressure from the prime minister, the defense minister, the interior minister to prevent this, said Gadi Zohar, a former senior army commander in the West Bank. The past 8 years, 10 Palestinians have been killed by settlers, while 29 settlers have been killed by Palestinians. 3 years after Israel was condemned internationally for the Mavi Marmara Gaza flotilla incident, it appears that Turkey is coming around to the Israeli view of things. As part of simultaneous operations against al-Qaeda in six Turkish provinces last week, Turkey's anti-terror police raided the offices of the IHH, the Islamic charity behind the 2010 Gaza flotilla. In addition to detaining one employee, the police seized all the organization's computers. The incident is one of several in recent months that would appear to vindicate Israel's stance that the Turkish-run flotilla was not the purely peaceful convoy it was made out to be in the media. 2 weeks ago, Turkish security forces stopped an IHH truck that was supposed to be carrying humanitarian aid to Syria, but was in fact filled with weapons. The IHH is known for its close ties to Turkey's government, in particular its ruling Justice and Development Party, headed by Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan, whose son Bilal is active in the group. The raids on the IHH coincide with a major power struggle taking place now within Turkey between Erdogan and the Gulen movement, and it may be an attempt to crack down on the prime minister's support base. Israel has long maintained that the IHH-sponsored Gaza flotilla in 2010 was never intended to be a peaceful operation. They pointed to the extensive trove of weapons found aboard the Mavi Marmara ship itself. Raided by IDF commandos, it resulted in the deaths of nine Turks and the terrorist links of many members of that group. This news from Turkey appears to bolster Israel's contention that at least some members of the flotilla were not humanitarians. If only 3 years too late to save Israel from international condemnation and from severely damaging Israel's formerly close relationship with Turkey, maybe this will move it back towards the right direction, as it has been creeping back. And a long-buried film the legendary director Alfred Hitchcock made for the British government documenting the horrors of the Nazi death camps has been revived and restored using digital technology. It'll be shown by early 2015. The film was prepared using footage taken during the liberation of the death camps. It was originally intended to be part of the re-education of the German public after the end of World War II. By the time the Hitchcock film was ready, it was late 1945, and the occupying powers no longer believed it would be helpful in their work of democratizing and Nazifying Germany. The documentary, Hitchcock's that is, was buried in the Imperial War Museum in London for years. One reel was actually lost. The restored movie will be shown next year for the 70th anniversary of the liberation of the camps. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world.
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Josh Weinberg, Rabbi Josh Weinberg, I should say, who is the head of ARTSA, the Association of Reform Zionists of America. I suppose I should say North America somewhere.
No, because there's an ARTSA Canada.
Oh, there's an ARTSA Canada. Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. Which is the organization that provides an avenue for Reform Jews and others to support liberal causes or pluralism in Israel in general. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on in Israel in terms of pluralism and the issues that exist mm-hmm. for Reform Judaism, which has grown by leaps and bounds, but is still certainly a minority in Israel.
Well, thanks a lot, Sam, and it's wonderful to be back in Tucson again.
Great to have you back. Actually, you were on a long time ago, and you were even younger.
True story. First of all, it's an exciting time. I'm really optimistic that things are changing and changing for the good. So, for instance, our reform movement, that the last time I was here in Tucson, I think we were barely above 30 communities. Now we're officially 42 communities throughout Israel, including our two kibbutzim. And if it weren't for the power and the strength of the reform movement with its support from the United States, we would not see the fast-paced change that's happening, for instance, at the Western Wall, at the Kotel, where we feel very, very confident that within the next year we're going to see serious change, and that there's going to be an egalitarian space, right, for Jews who don't feel comfortable praying separated men and women.
Right.
Right? That is a massive, massive change, right? And it's because of the power of the world movements as well that come back. We've also passed significant resolutions in the World Zionist Organization. One, calling that Israel should adopt civil unions and civil marriages. We're all about upholding the Declaration of Independence of Israel, which calls for democracy and calls for everyone to have freedom of religion and freedom from religion, which is not always, sometimes taken for granted. We passed a resolution calling on the government of Israel to prosecute those who receive government salaries that are violating laws of racism. Okay, I was telling to a friend of mine who works in Washington, and he said, well, what do you mean? Of course they should prosecute. I said, well, it's not that obvious. It's not that obvious. There's a government salaried rabbi in the north who urges Jews not to sell their home to Arabs.
Yep.
That's against the law. And he has to be prosecuted for that. Right? And those things are happening, and so we have to find a way to enforce civil rights, pluralism, democracy, and make sure that Israel has a voice for all Jews there.
So it's not just a question of personal religious practice in Israel, for example, of Jews who want to affiliate with the Reform Synagogue and see that it's supported, but it's also a question, a broader question of civil rights.
It's also civil rights, and I think it's an issue of civil society. So I think that Israelis are hungry for Judaism. I think that Israelis have come to the realization that having an identity affiliated with the state and with a Jewish state, that the Jewish state doesn't necessarily mean that they have a Jewish community. And they see the things that some of us take for granted from, at least I knew growing up in the States, the Jewish state's not going to pour coffee at your uncle's shiva.
Hmm.
And they're realizing, we want a community too. And we want to have these things. And you know what? We have lots of questions about what it means to be Jewish. And who do we want to give the answers?
Arza goes back to a time when the Reform Movement was really trying to build Zionism within its ranks. Many synagogues had, a tepid response to supporting Israel. Now it's pretty hard to find a synagogue in America that isn't very strongly pro-Zionist, pro-Israel. But it's not so hard to find many younger Jews who don't have the same positive associations that a lot of us might.
Right. And I don't know I would necessarily agree. I think I'm finding lots of synagogues where people are afraid to talk about Israel,
mm-hmm.
Where there's a prominent J Street group and a prominent APAC group, and so what they've just done is just agree to not talk about it at all. And that really breaks my heart. I want people talking about Israel. Someone asked me, they said, how are you going to deal with all the criticism for Israel? I said, criticism is great. Because what it means? It means that they're engaged. And it means that they're paying attention to what's going on in Israel to come up with criticism. That's already impressive. And I think the young generation is a difficult issue across the board. I don't think it's just issues of Israel that people are, not engaged with or estranged from. I think it's Jewish identity.
In general,
I know that when Jewish identity is strong, Israel identity is strong, Israel connections are strong. And I think we have to find those issues that speak to the young people. I told a group of, predominantly white-haired individuals who said, what about the young people? And how come we're not getting them involved? I said, well, what we have to do? We have to ask the young people. What is it that they're interested in? What is it that could engage them, that could be important for them to understand? So, for instance, I think the issue of pluralism and openness in Israel and creating a society that's inviting and that's recognizing of each person's Jewish identity and where they come from could be a key issue to bringing in lots of young people.
Let's talk about those World Zionist elections again, because mm-hmm. it's a complicated issue that I think very few American Jews understand.
Mm-hmm.
World Zionist Organization was founded a long time ago, as the way of eventually founding the State of Israel.
1897.
Right? The formative organization of which led eventually to the State of Israel. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are people who don't understand why it still exists since there is a State of Israel.
That's
Can
right.
you explain a little bit about what the Zionist organization is?
Yeah, I think, you know, and we joke sometimes when we sit at the meetings that the World Zionist Organization is a 19th century socialist organization run by 21st century capitalists.
Yeah.
And it still exists because it's the way really to voice the diaspora opinion and what happens in Israel. Right? It's kind of ironic. You think that the people living outside the State of Israel who are not necessarily citizens get to say what happens. What really comes down to, we get to control the budget. What happens is, if we're donating money, we should have a say in where it goes.
Sure.
And that's a direct way for us to connect.
Or at the very least, to influence the 100% budget
100%.
Of the State of Israel.
And voting helps us say, well, this is where we align ideologically. And this is where we want to see the State of Israel going. And because essentially we want to be proud of the State of Israel. So the World Zionist Organization is a way to galvanize and a way to organize world Jewry and align them ideologically on how we feel about Israel.
So dependent on how many people you have in each block at the World Zionist Organization, mm-hmm. in other words,
each faction,
faction delegates.
Yeah.
It's like a giant Knesset, or
yeah, exactly. The way I'll give you one sentence about how it works,
please.
There are 512 seats, similar to the U.S. Congress.
Yeah, almost the same.
And the United States gets 145 seats. So, last elections, which were 10 years ago, we did very well. We got 51% of that 145, which gave us a lot of power. I think that we need to do considerably better this time. I'd like to get 100,000 votes, which will put us up. So it means that when it comes time in the beginning of 2015, I need every Jewish person who's over the age of 18 to sign on and vote for Arza.
And if that takes place, then that will lead to an increase in funding for liberal Jewish organizations, progressive Jewish organizations. Usually
that's
the term is that's used in Israel is progressive, not so much liberal.
Right, and the movement in Israel has adopted the word reform,
right.
And their website is reform.org.il.
Okay.
And they are, in Hebrew, they say the Tnoa HaReformit, right?
The reform movement.
The reform movement, exactly. And they've reform can sometimes be a pejorative in Israel.
Sure.
It's what are you guys, reform? And it's a movement, it's an idea to try to take that back a little bit. So yes, we're proud to be reform, because reform stands for stands for interpretation, it stands for inclusion, it stands for being non-threatening, it stands for offering alternatives that will bring more people in.
Tell me what else Arza is active in. I know this is the key issue, but maybe mm-hmm. as a final question. What else is Arza active in? What are other ways that people can support Arza and get involved?
Sure, we're active in partnering with different organizations in terms of thinking about what can you do in Israel, what kind of programming you can have in your synagogue, in your community. We're going to be bringing a Torah scroll through the entire United States and marching it into the Kotel during the summertime.
Right, so that's starting maybe in January.
Hopefully.
From California and headed across every state in the
United States. And headed east, as many as we can get.
Okay.
As many as we can get.
And then that will be taken by the Women of the Wall to the Kotel to chant from?
To the Kotel to read from, in public, and then donate it to one of our communities in Israel.
That's a fantastic project. Yeah. And where can people find out more about Arza?
It'll be on our website, arza.org.
So it's arza.org.
And we're in the process of redoing the website and redoing our whole communicational approach. And the most important thing that we can do right now is to become members.
And so the best way to become members is to go to the Arza website.
Mm-hmm.
And
or to do it through your local synagogue.
Okay, so go to your local Reform synagogue. Temple Emmanuel in Tucson, Arizona, if you wish. And there you can sign up for the World Zionist Organization, register and vote.
Yeah, in the coming year, you'll be able to do it right now.
January 2015.
Exactly.
So go through
exactly.
the process. It starts now.
Exactly.
Josh, mazel tov on becoming the president of Arza.
Thank you.
And good luck with all of these projects, and we will check back in and see how they progress.
Yes, and it's lovely to be in Tucson. I look forward to many more visits.
Sounds great. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Mitch Albom, the author of Tuesdays with Maury, and a guy who has a new book out, The First Phone Call from Heaven. Our playout this morning comes in memory of Ariel Sharon, former Prime Minister of Israel. It's also from the Yom Kippur War, Naomi Shemer's beautiful Lu Yihi, sung by Chava Alberstein. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
יש מפרס לבן באופק מול ענן שחור כבד כל שנבקש לו יהי ואם בחלונות הערב אור נרות החג רועד כל שנבקש לו יהי בדלת תן מילה טובה בפיו כל שנבקש לו יהי אם נפשך למות שואלת מפריחה ומאסיף כל שנבקש לו יהי